Welcome to another edition of Blue Republican Radio for the Liberty Curious. This is me, Robin Kerner, the original Blue Republican, and I'm looking forward to talking about something today that we haven't discussed since the Blue Republican Radio show began a few months ago, and it's an important issue for libertarians, conservatives, and indeed all Americans. We're going to talk about the Second Amendment, and I'm kind of in the mood to talk about the Second Amendment because a couple of weekends ago, I was up in Whatcom County, up there near the Canadian border, at a range, for only the second time in my life, trying out and learning about all kinds of firearms, and I have to say, much to the initial surprise of my mother, I had a great time doing it. We might talk a little bit in this show later about why my mother should be so shocked that her son liked shooting a few guns. I know lots of liberals in this country are shocked that anybody would enjoy and be passionate about things that kill people, but there's good reason for it, and we might discuss that a little bit today. Another reason why we're going to talk about the Second Amendment on this show is that in my home state of Washington, there are some interesting pieces of legislation coming down the pipeline that have huge implications, potentially, for gun rights, for gun owners, and for the government's registration of us as private citizens. And to discuss this and related issues, I have a gentleman here, Brian Judy, representative of the NRA. He's a legislative liaison who works in four states here in the West. And I'm just going to ask him to tell you exactly what that role entails. So, Brian, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be with you.
It's good to have you. So please do a better job than I have just done explaining what it is that you do and where in these United States that you do it.
As you described, I am a legislative liaison for the National Rifle Association Institute for Legislative Action. In that position, I deal with all things government affairs related. I'm based out of our Sacramento Government Affairs Office. There's three of us there. Between us, we cover nine states. I happen to monitor activity in Alaska, Utah, Montana, and your home state here of Washington. So during the legislative session, I'm working as a lobbyist, trying to educate legislators on firearms issues that would relate to our members, good or bad. And then right now, this time of year, all my legislative sessions are out. They're all part-time legislatures. Mm-hmm. So I am working on elections, evaluating candidates, and determining where our members should get involved to help elect legislators who will be friendly to the Second Amendment.
Now, what about ballot initiatives, Brian?
Well, part of the electoral process is ballot initiatives. And in the state of Washington, there actually are two firearm-related initiatives this year on the 2014 general election ballot. And they grew out of legislation that was introduced in Olympia. It did not pass. So a group of very progressive, wealthy elitists bought a few hundred thousand signatures and qualified a very egregious initiative for the ballot. And we are working to educate voters on the truth about the initiative because they're not getting much accurate information from the proponents. So it's going to be a very interesting campaign season in Washington.
So let me ask you first off, is what is going on here in Washington, does it hold lessons for people in the rest of the country, potentially? Is this legislation representative of things that are being tried or may be tried in other parts of the U.S.?
Yes, absolutely. It's Initiative 594. And what Initiative 594 would do, well, what it would do and what the proponents say it would do are two different things. What the proponents say it would do is very simply impose background checks on private sales of firearms like retail commercial sales of firearms are subject to. And all your listeners throughout the country should be very aware of this issue because it was pushed very, very strenuously by President Obama in 2013 following the tragedy in Newtown. So they ran legislation in 2013 here in Olympia, Washington as well. They were not able to get it through, so they drafted an initiative. And I should point out that the legislation in Olympia was 2.5 pages. The initiative, ballot initiative 594, is 18 pages. It's extraordinarily complicated, complex, much more so than the 2-page bill that was moving in Olympia.
Okay.
So it is an issue that has national implications. I think we'll probably see it in many other states aside from Washington.
Now, if we're talking 18-plus pages, then I'm guessing this bill that you're fighting hard, that the NRA are fighting hard, does more than mandate background checks on commercial firearms transactions. Is that right?
You are very insightful.
So tell us what more it seeks to do.
It really is not about so-called universal background checks. What it's really about is universal handgun registration. And it's not about sales. The other side says, well, simply private sales of firearms should go through the same process that commercial sales go through from firearms dealers. But they've drafted it so broadly that it doesn't impact only sales. It impacts all transfers. And transfers is defined so broadly, and there are some exceptions, but they are drafted so narrowly that the provisions of Initiative 594 are essentially going to regulate virtually any transfer of a firearm, virtually any time of any firearm changes hands between private citizens, whether it's a sale to your best friend or a loan to your brother or your son, it would have to go through this bureaucratic process that's established in this proposed initiative.
So let's just be absolutely clear here. What we're saying is the proponents of this legislation are seeking to set up a situation in which if I had a son and lent him my gun to go to the range, you know, for a few hours for some target practice or whatever, then once he leaves my house with my gun in his hand, one of us has committed some kind of crime?
Gross misdemeanor, and it's a felony on the second offense.
Wow. Okay, now.
And one other point on the penalty section, it also says that the transfer of two firearms constitute separate offenses. So technically, if I loan my son both of my shotguns,
right,
and he goes to the range without me, then the first gun is the gross misdemeanor, and the second transfer is a felony. Now, it's questionable whether prosecutors would really enforce that, but that's another whole problem with this thing, is the unfunded mandate and the enforcement nightmare and the unwitting violations that it's going to create.
What do the proponents say when you present to them this simple, concrete example of the absurdity of this proposed law? What's the response?
They call me a liar.
Now,
they call me a liar. They say Mr. Judy is lying. This does not require what I say it does.
So,
it in fact does. And whenever I'm speaking, I've debated the other side many, many times. And whenever I debate the other side, I stand there at the podium with a copy of the initiative in my hand, and I point to specific provisions in this proposed initiative. And it is staggering to me, actually, that they have the audacity to lie through their teeth. And when I'm standing there with a copy of the bill pointing out the facts, they call me a liar. It's staggering.
Now, we've only got 30 seconds left in this segment, but I've got to kind of push this a little bit. Are you telling me that when they're standing up on stage next to you, they are denying the meaning of words?
That is absolutely right. And yes, very observant. Words mean things, and that's what we are looking at, the words of the initiative, and they are ignoring it and obfuscating the entire proposal that they have drafted.
Wow. Okay, well, this is going to clearly give us lots to talk about when we come back from the break that we are now going into. We'll be back soon. Welcome to the second segment of this episode of Blue Republican Radio for the non-dogmatic, liberty-curious Americans among you. I guess here I am talking to Brian Judy, representative, legislative liaison of the NRA in four states in the west of our nation. And what he's telling me, I think, is shocking me, but not surprising me. I think that's fair to say. Brian finds himself, correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, Brian, standing up on stage with people who are pushing anti-Second Amendment legislation, and they are insisting that the meaning of words is not what actually the words that they are saying mean. Is that fair?
That is absolutely correct.
Now, I this makes me kind of want to come and watch you do one of these things. Because I'm sure I would get lots of material for my articles, you know, just probably, it's kind of where satire ends, right? Where you can just quote politicians denying that the language that they use. But, I think your job must be endlessly fascinating, if not completely frustrating. We talked about registration, which is obviously a really important issue. And a lot of the debate, if it is even a debate, seems to be around what that actually means. I mean, here you are saying that this bill, I-594, as it is up here in Washington State, will create a register of gun owners and indeed every individual transfer of a firearm, including the loaning of one to your brother or son or your best friend. That seems on its face, given what you've described, to be just a fair description of exactly what it does. What is their definition of registration that enables them to say it doesn't create a register? Can you even answer that question?
Well, let me say this. Technically, it doesn't create the registry. Right now, if you buy a handgun from a dealer, that commercial sale involves a pistol transfer application. That's a state form. It's a triplicate form. One copy goes to local law enforcement. One copy stays with the dealer, and the triplicate goes to the State Department of Licensing. So the State Department of Licensing is currently maintaining a registration database of law-abiding handgun owners who bought a firearm through a commercial channel. This initiative would require, as I explained earlier, most private transfers, not sales, but loans, virtually all transfers. There are some exemptions. They're very narrow.
Okay.
But all those transfers of handguns are going to be subject to this process, and it is going to cause the registration, the entry of names of law-abiding handgun owners into this centralized government-maintained registration database.
Now, okay, so here's a question. What fraction of people with a firearm now would be on, let's say, on the kind of current register by virtue of the fact that they obtain their firearm commercially? Are we talking most or are we talking a minority?
That is an excellent question that nobody knows the answer to. the Obama administration and the proponents of Initiative 594 claim that 40% of gun sales are not subject to the commercial background check that's currently in place. But that statistic has been ridiculed by the Washington Post. The Washington Post, the liberal paper, not the Washington Times, the Washington Post fact checker gave Obama's use of that quote three Pinocchios. And that means there is significant factual error and or obvious contradiction. So I point that out because it's an example of the other side making things up, and to the point where the Washington Post calls them out on it.
Okay, so what we're talking about, let's just be clear, because language is important. So this bill doesn't actually create a new registry. What it does is, expands the scope of the current registry, if we call the government's maintaining of records about gun owners, gun purchasers, a registry.
That is correct. That the other side is starting. I mean, they have been adamant that this does not have registration in it, and they are starting to crack a little bit in their discussion. They're starting to say, well, Mr. Judy says it creates a registration database, and it doesn't create a registration database. There's already a registration database, and this would add to it. But then when you talk to them off camera, they refuse to acknowledge that it's a registration database. They say, well, it's not registration, it's a database.
So what actually is the difference?
They're trying to parse words and they're trying to create the perception that it's not about handgun registration when it clearly is.
Now, taking all political ideology out of this for a moment, it does seem on its face reasonable that everybody who has or acquires a firearm, regardless of how they acquired it, should be treated the same way, in that they should either all be registered or none of them should be registered. I mean, is there any argument at all for this kind of arbitrary division between those who acquired the firearm in a certain way, you know, through a retail gun shop, say, and those that acquired it in any other way? I mean, there's no good reason for that, is there?
Well, the NRA's position is that law-abiding gun owners should not be subject to government compilation of their names in a centralized database. Because if you look at history in a lot of other countries, and if you look in the United States, in California, in New York, in Connecticut, databases of law-abiding gun owners have been used to go back and knock on the door and say, you've got this firearm, it's now been made illegal, you need to turn it in.
What is the NRA's position then on background checks without maintaining of the data about the people whose backgrounds have been checked? Can you accept that a government or a government agency could check fitness to have a firearm and then not maintain that data in a database? Would that be acceptable to the NRA?
In the mid-90s, the National Instant Check System was implemented. And it started off as a 5-day waiting period and a background check. And then with technology, they were able to sunset the waiting period into a National Instant Check System. The NRA supported that under three conditions. It had to be instant. There could be no compilation of information on law-abiding gun owners, and there should be no cost. We do not view this as a user fee. We believe that to the extent there is any societal benefit for a background check, and quite frankly, we just don't believe there is any utility, and we can get into that in a little bit, but to the extent there is any utility, it's a benefit to society as a whole, and society as a whole should shoulder the burden. If it's such a great program, fund it out of the general fund. Don't hit gun owners up for the costs.
And is that where we are now with the government doing those background checks and at least purporting not to maintain that database?
That is correct, and that's another observant point. As technology expands and we're going from paper records to electronic records, I think it raises real concerns among gun owners that, in fact, the information is not being destroyed as the legislation requires it to be. But then there's the other question of effectiveness and enforceability. Right now, the other side claims that 80,000 people per year are stopped at that commercial point of purchase from obtaining a firearm.
Okay, you know what, Brian? Hold on to this thought, because we're going into the break and we're going to come and talk about this in the third segment.
Okay.
Into the break, Brian Judy was beginning to talk about the issues of enforceability when it comes to some of this firearms and related registration legislation. Brian, carry on with your thoughts, please.
So the question is, can this national instant check system that the other side wants to expand to all private transfers, is it effective? Can it be enforced? And a simple look at reality offers the obvious, clear answer, no. The last year that statistics are available is 2010. And in 2010, 76,000 people were denied. They went to a commercial gun dealer and tried to buy a firearm, and they were denied. Okay. Now, you have to realize that a lot of those denials are a guy named John Smith, who has the same name as 10 other John Smiths with criminal records. So it takes a little time to sort through that.
Hold on, they don't use social security numbers, Brian?
I'm sorry?
Don't they use social security numbers?
No.
So this is done just on...
I don't believe they do.
Oh, how astonishing. Okay, carry on.
So anyway, there are a lot of wrongful denials that are eventually overturned.
Okay.
Bottom line is, from that 76,000, that initial number, 76,000 denials, you work through the denials that are referred to ATF, that's the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, ATF field divisions, and then how many of those referrals result in charges, and then how many of those charges actually are prosecuted. So in 2010, of that 76,000, there were 13 prosecutions.
Now, these are prosecutions for what exactly? Because it's 76,000 denials. If you're denied a firearm, who's getting prosecuted for what?
Well, you're being prosecuted for the illegal attempt to purchase a firearm, because under federal law, the attempt by a prohibited person to attempt to purchase a firearm is a crime. So out of 76,000, 13 are prosecuted. The bottom line is, if the existing law is not being enforced. And Vice President Biden was asked about this. Why does the Obama administration provide a near total lack of enforcement? And his response was, we simply don't have the time or manpower to prosecute everybody who lies on a form or who checks the wrong box. Well, they've made this a federal felony. They say we need to keep guns out of bad guys' hands, but they refuse to enforce the law. So if you're not going to enforce the existing law, and now you're going to ramp it up with who knows how many additional private transfers, not private sales, but you're going to add to this universe, they're going to be even less able and apt to enforce it. So the real criminals are not going to be stopped by this. If it really was a criminal and not John Smith, who's just trying to buy a firearm, and he does get denied, he has a virtually non-existent chance of being prosecuted. And where's he going to go? He's going to go where most criminals go in the first place. That's to the black market. That is to illegal sources such as drug dealers. That is straw purchases. The back alley where criminals get their drugs.
Now, hold on. This is kind of interesting, though, because it does seem in one way that the thrust of this argument, Brian, puts the NRA on the side of stronger enforcement of existing gun regulation, if you see what I mean.
Well, right. And that's – and like I said, we don't believe – the NRA does not believe that there's much utility in this law, and the total lack of enforcement – just hammers that home, but even if it was enforced, it's unlikely. I think that the vast majority of those denials are, you know, somebody who had a criminal record from 35 years ago when they were 17 and a hoodlum, and now they're 52 and they've had a clean record ever since. They decide they want to buy a firearm, they go down and they're denied because of this 35-year-old criminal record.
As a matter of principle, this is an interesting question to me. As a matter of principle, would the NRA rather have the situation with the current law unenforced because in some way it limits the right to bear arms? Or would they rather have the current situation with the current law enforced precisely because all laws should be enforced? And it's even worse to have gun laws on the books that aren't enforced. Which is it? Which is better?
You know, I don't think that there is. I don't think the NRA really has an opinion on which is better. But okay. If you are going to have a law on the books, it needs to be enforced, and there needs to be evidence that it is providing some societal benefit before you ramp it up and expand it exponentially.
Sure. Okay. So coming back to the actual initiative in Washington State, which kind of crystallizes some of this. What enforcement mechanisms do the proponents say that will be put in place?
They don't. They just have the penalty of a gross misdemeanor for the first violation. And then it's up to law enforcement to enforce it. And all the law enforcement officials and organizations that we are speaking to are coming out in opposition to 594 because they realize it's an unfunded mandate. It's, first of all, they're going to have to be doing these background checks on predominantly law-abiding citizens that are never going to be prosecuted,
right?
Because it's just not possible. They understand it's unenforceable. They understand that it's just going to make criminals out of otherwise law-abiding citizens. Law enforcement doesn't necessarily, at least the ones we're talking to, and most law enforcement are on the opposition side right now. There's very few that support it, but they don't like the idea of registration because law enforcement officers are, for the most part, gun guys, and there's no exemption for off-duty cops. If two police officers get together at one guy's house and they're showing each other their personal backup firearms, they can't exchange those. There's no exemption. So they are going to be committing a gross – these law enforcement officers are going to be committing these gross misdemeanors if they don't comply. And if they do comply, then they're going to be put in the registration database, and they don't like it any more than non-law enforcement gun owners.
Now, what are the other problems? I know that you said there's a few – points, problems with this initiative. What other ones are there that we haven't discussed?
Well, let's see. I guess we've covered the point that if it were to pass, it would not prevent criminals from obtaining firearms. They're going to go through illegitimate channels. We talked somewhat about the excessive regulatory scheme that's going to subject all these private transfers, a loan to your brother, a sale to your sister-in-law,
yeah,
to go through the dealer and be subject to fees and paperwork and use taxes. And in the case of handguns, they're doubling the state waiting period from 5 to 10 days. Even though we've had an instant check on the federal level for almost 20 years, they're doubling the waiting period from 5 to 10 years in the state of Washington.
5 to 10 days with a view to what? For what purpose? Why?
You'd have to ask them about that.
Okay.
I guess my opinion.
Go on then. Let's have that.
They're just trying to make it as bureaucratic and onerous as possible on law-abiding gun owners. They just don't like guns,
okay,
and they want to make it as hard as possible to get guns, and they want to put handgun owners into this government registration database so they know who has them. And if we have a minute, I can talk a little bit about that.
Sure, we have a few minutes. Go right ahead.
Okay, so I've been asking the question when I've been speaking to groups, why do these billionaires, and you have to understand that the other side's already raised $2.5 million. They spent $1.5 million buying signatures to qualify this thing for the ballot, and
How do you buy signatures, Brian? How do you do that? What do you mean buying signatures?
You pay professional signature gatherers to go out and stand on the corner and collect signatures from passersby, and they pay them a certain amount per signature. So
okay, that seems that seems like a fair thing to do if that's what you wanted to achieve. Pay somebody
well, sure.
to do it. Right?
Yeah. Okay. That's the law. That's legal. But the point is, you have these billionaires who are funding this thing. Michael Bloomberg, the former New York City mayor and chief nanny for this country. A guy named Nick Hanauer, who is he's a billionaire, venture capitalist. He was one of the early investors in Amazon.com. And here's the point I make. So why do these billionaires want to create a registration database of law-abiding handgun owners? Just last week, in Politico.com, the online version, Nick Hanauer wrote an article called "The Pitchforks Are Coming for Us Plutocrats," and it's in the form of a memo from Nick Hanauer to "quote unquote" his fellow zillionaires, and he brags about being one of the 0.01%ers, billionaire, yacht owner, and he's discussing this article how. In elsewhere in history, when there was such a disparity between the zillionaires and the common folks rose up and went after the plutocrats with pitchforks.
Yeah.
And I think it's very interesting that he writes this article, and perhaps what he wants is when that happens, he wants the average folks coming at him with pitchforks and not firearms.
Pitchforks, not pistols. It almost sounds the same, doesn't it?
you can't make this stuff up.
It is very interesting. I mean, we certainly are at a time in history where, a time of flux. And I one thing in my work that I'm often saying to the Liberty Movement is that we need to harness that. I mean, we need to be out there explaining how we got there, and how you got there is largely a violation of individual liberties. The values on which this country's founded. This is a teachable moment for America, and it's teachable for the same reason that the 0.01% should be worried, I guess. But you know what? We've got a few minutes left in this long third segment. We've got about three and a half, four minutes left. So I want to ask you something, Brian, that I've been thinking about recently, especially since that time up on the range a few weekends ago that I mentioned at the beginning of the show. I think that in the United States, we think there's a big political divide between gun owners and those who would, you know, regulate and control gun ownerships. But I don't perceive it as a political divide primarily. I perceive it primarily as a cultural one. And I think it's rather like, in this sense, the apparent political divide between those who, let's say, support gay marriage and those who think that same-sex marriage is going to destroy marriage for the rest of society. I kind of see that if you're the average progressive, and I was a liberal by default for most of my life, and I was a British one too. So for me, firearms were a complete cultural anathema. So my kind of normal point of view would have been, I'm a nice guy. I can't imagine getting kind of turned on by guns or getting interested in some device that whose primary purpose is to kill people. So those that kind of are interested in that, there's got to be something a little bit weird about them. There's something suspect about them. I can't really identify with them. And frankly, I think that's the same attitude, for example, that some religious people might have with some gay people. It's this cultural divide. We react kind of emotionally out of a cultural divide, and then we kind of retrofit political rationalizations onto it. Now, I'm explaining all that to you, Brian, because I want to ask you, does that fit your experience in the work that you do? That sometimes you just have to kind of break through this maybe visceral resistance to you from, let's say, the progressive left?
Absolutely. And that is the classic situation in Washington State. As I said, I'm sure that they bought 95% of their signatures probably within a 20-mile radius of downtown Seattle.
Sure.
So you absolutely have a cultural divide between all those urban progressives and everybody else out there, Republicans and Democrats who live in the more rural parts of the state, for whom firearms are an everyday way of life.
Now, so with that in mind, how does the pro-gun, the pro-Second Amendment community, reach across that cultural divide? How is it that you get those who want to regulate your guns to start making friends with you? And I mean that literally, making friends, not agree with you politically in the first instance, but just bring you into their world and see that you're no different from them.
Well, yeah, it's a matter of trying to work with them, and that's what I do in Olympia. And we work on legislation. We do try to find common ground, and sometimes we can find common ground. And if you look at these high-profile incidents, you have two types of criminals. You have your garden-variety criminal, robber, raper, murderer, and they just get their guns through the black market, through illegal sources. But we have a new category now of criminals, and it's these...
Brian, hold on to the thought. We're going into the last break. Hold on to the thought, and we'll finish the show with this thought.
Okay.
Goes so quickly when you get your teeth into a topic, doesn't it? Brian, you were closed out the last segment by mentioning a new variety of criminals. Finish our show by continuing that thought, please.
Yes. So we have these dangerously unstable individuals who are committing atrocities, like Newtown, like the recent Seattle Pacific University incident. And virtually the two big spokespeople for the legislation that led to this initiative were former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords from Arizona, who came in and testified for the bill, and a woman named Cheryl Stumbo, who was a victim of a mass shooting in downtown Seattle at the Jewish Federation. And they were both victims of dangerously unstable individuals. But in both of those cases, and in virtually every other case, in the Fort Hood shootings and the recent Santa Barbara shooting, the individuals, the perpetrators, bought their firearms from dealers going through legitimate channels. So the common threads in virtually every one of these incidents is a dangerously unstable individual. In most cases, they were gun-free zones, where, in fact, only the victims were gun-free, and we could probably spend an hour talking about that issue at some point in the future, the utility of guns, so-called gun-free zones. Psychiatric medications, virtually every one of these perpetrators were on psychiatric drugs, and background checks. Background checks just aren't stopping, and it's stopping these incidents. So it's so ironic and disappointing that these people are pushing this issue, implying that it's going to stop the type of incident that they were victimized in, when it's just not going to. It's not going to stop the dangerously unstable. It's not going to stop the garden variety criminals. Initiative 594 does nothing to address the issue of mental health. That's where we need to be focusing. We need to get the gun community, the anti-gun community, the mental health community, the law enforcement community. We all need to come together and try to figure out real solutions to these problems, not feel-good measures that are going to have no impact on the problems we are facing as a society.
That's a constructive message with which to end the show, and indeed maybe that sets us up for an entirely new show. That is the end of this show. Thank you for joining me, Brian Judy, and thank you, audience, for joining me too.